The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'm going to be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and probably from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter as well. My first article is from the Harvard Heart Letter and is called A Daily Drink Not as Harmless as You Might Think. Contrary to popular belief, even modest amounts of alcohol may raise heart disease risk. In recent years, the long-held notion that alcohol is good for your heart has slowly started to dry up. Now, a new study suggests that any amount of alcohol, even one drink per day, may raise rather than lower a person's risk of cardiovascular disease. We found that along the entire spectrum of alcohol consumption, the risk of high blood pressure and coronary artery disease increases rather than decreases, says Dr. Krishna Aragam, a cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital, and the study's lead author. But the amount matters quite a bit, he says. If you have up to 7 drinks per week, the added risk to your heart is minimal. If you go above that amount, the risk rises exponentially. Observational studies dating back to the early 1990s linked light to moderate drinking, 1 or 2 drinks per day, to a lower risk of heart disease. But such studies can't prove that the alcohol was responsible for the benefit. Light to moderate drinkers tend to be well-educated, fairly affluent, and likely to have healthy lifestyle habits, all of which may explain their lower risk. Researchers can attempt to control for these so-called confounding factors, but it's tricky to capture all the possible influences. The new study was published in the March 25th, 2022 issue of JAMA Network Open. It included data on nearly 400,000 people from UK Biobank, a large database of health and genetic information in the United Kingdom. The participants, whose average age was 57, reported consuming 9.2 drinks per week on average. Because the study was so large, the scientists were able to estimate the added risk at different levels of alcohol consumption. As had been previously shown, light to moderate drinking went hand in hand with a lower risk of heart disease. But after the researchers adjusted for 6 factors, smoking, physical activity, body mass index, red meat consumption, cooked vegetable intake, and self-reported health, the benefits just about disappeared. But Dr. Aragam and his colleagues went a step further. They also looked at specific genetic variants that track closely with how much alcohol a person drinks. These variants are unlikely to be related to other lifestyle factors and occur randomly within the population. The researchers found that people with genetic variants that predicted higher alcohol consumption did indeed drink more and were also more likely to have high blood pressure and coronary artery disease. It's important to note that the risk assessed in this study pertains to the first-time diagnosis of a heart-related issue. The risk from alcohol may be even greater for people who already have cardiovascular disease, but this study does not address that question, says Dr. Aragam. Moreover, there is compelling scientific evidence that for people with atrial fibrillation, cutting back on alcohol clearly reduces episodes of the rapid, irregular heart rate that characterizes the disorder. Currently, the federal dietary guidelines suggest that if you drink, you should limit yourself to fewer than 15 drinks per week if you're a male, and 8 if you're a female. But the new data suggests that men should stick to the lower limit as well, a suggestion that was initially considered but ultimately rejected during the last update of the guidelines. I'm now telling my patients that if you have up to 7 drinks per week, your risk of heart disease does not decrease, but instead will increase. Because the added risk is minimal, cutting back isn't necessarily a big priority. People can only focus on so much at a time. So if I have a patient who smokes, is overweight, and has one drink per day, I'd prioritize stopping smoking and losing weight over cutting back on alcohol. But if a person has more than one drink per day, it's a different conversation. I make it clear that no amount of alcohol is good for you, but if you can cut down to one drink instead of 2 or 3 per day, you'll get most of the benefit right there, says Dr. Aragam. How should you go about cutting back on alcohol? It's a good idea to follow some tips. You should keep a drinking journal. Write down what and how much you drink for a few weeks to get a better sense of how much you imbibe. Don't keep any alcohol in your house. Doing so can limit your drinking to social occasions or restaurants and may discourage you from drinking simply out of habit. Dilute the alcohol and sip slowly. Dilute your wine or cocktail with sparkling water and ice. Take your time drinking it. Also, you should establish alcohol-free days. Choose several days every week to steer clear of all alcohol. And then there's a little guide that explains what is meant by a standard drink. In other words, if you should not drink more than 7 drinks per week, what's a drink? Well, a drink is 12 ounces of regular beer or 8 ounces of malt liquor or 5 ounces of table wine or 1.5 ounces of any distilled spirit like gin, rum, or whiskey. The article goes on to describe a meal of the month. And the meal of the month is a plate of pasta. Pasta is a popular choice for a quick and easy vegetarian meal. All you have to do is boil noodles, drain, and add some sauce. There's just one small problem. Most pasta is made from white flour, and this refined carbohydrate isn't the healthiest option. With just a little effort, you can ramp up the nutritional quality of a pasta dinner by choosing one of the many alternative noodle options and adding a variety of vegetables to your pasta dish. With a simple hand-crank tool called a spiralizer, you can make your own noodles from vegetables like zucchini or yellow squash. Or try pasta made from whole wheat flour, buckwheat flour, edamame, chickpeas, or red lentils, all of which are higher in fiber and protein than traditional white pasta. Complete your pasta dish with a mixture of your favorite chopped vegetables. In a large skillet, sauté the vegetables with onion and garlic and olive oil. Add the drained hot pasta to the pan, drizzle with a little more olive oil, and mix well. Sprinkle with chopped fresh basil or other herbs and Parmesan cheese. Now we're going to continue with the Harvard Heart Letter. The next article is, do you really need that heart test or procedure? Low-value cardiovascular care is common, costly, and can be harmful. If a doctor says you need a stress test or a stent, it's only natural to assume the results will improve your health in some way. But that's not always the case. In some situations, heart-related tests and procedures offer no clear benefit. This so-called low-value care isn't just a waste of time and money. It may also promote anxiety and lead to potentially harmful complications. Up to half of all stress tests done in the United States may be considered rarely appropriate, says a scientific statement from the American Heart Association published in the March 2022 issue of Circulation, Cardiovascular Quality, and Outcomes. What drives this problem? What can you do about it? Overuse of certain tests may happen because they're widely available and may provide financial benefits to the healthcare center. They may be done in people who don't meet criteria, like having chest pain or other concerning symptoms that warrant testing. And sometimes the results from an initial test are unclear, which can trigger additional, more invasive tests that can increase a person's risk, their anxiety, and their expense. Will it change your care? When a physician proposes a test, it's always reasonable to ask how the results might change your treatment, says cardiologist Dr. Jason S. Wasfi, director of cardiovascular outcomes research at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. This question can trigger a discussion that could help you better understand what's going on and give your doctor a clearer sense of any concerns you may have, he says. Be sure you understand what the results could lead to, not just in terms of medications or procedures, but also any potential follow-up tests. You can also ask if you could get a similar information from a different test that's safer, with no radiation, for example, or less costly. Medical costs are skyrocketing, and health insurance companies are increasingly shifting the financial burden onto patients, Dr. Wasfi notes. As the AHA statement explains, much of the low-value cardiovascular care in this country occurs in people who've already been diagnosed with heart disease. An example would be a person who received a stent or had bypass surgery, but gets a yearly stress test despite feeling fine. For the most part, stress tests are best used to help diagnose people who are likely to develop heart disease, those with several risk factors like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes, and who are experiencing bouts of chest pain during physical activity. Another example is the coronary artery calcium scan, which Dr. Wasfi describes as the least useful test imaginable for a person who already has known coronary artery disease. The appropriate use of a CAC scan is to help clarify a person's risk of coronary artery disease, especially if the person is wondering whether to start taking cholesterol-lowering statins. As for low-value procedures, an estimated 15% of stent placements are classified as rarely appropriate. For people with stable angina, stents do not prevent heart attacks or death better than medication. For more information, look at the Choosing Wisely campaign at www.choosingwisely.org. That's choosingwisely.org. an initiative from the American Board of Internal Medicine, which provides information for patients about a wide range of health tests and procedures, including exercise stress tests, echocardiograms for heart valve disease, and treatments for stable angina. The write-ups detail why you might not need a test, including its potential risks and complications. They also clarify and describe situations in which a specific test or procedure probably makes sense. Now we're going to read an article in the Harvard Heart Letter that's entitled Stronger Body, Healthier Heart. Spending a little as half an hour each week on strength-building exercises is linked to a lower risk of premature death from heart disease. If you're in the habit of doing a 20 to 30 minute brisk walk or other moderate exercise most days of the week, that's fantastic. But a lot of people neglect the recommendation in the Federal Physical Activity Guidelines for Americans to do muscle strengthening exercise 2 days a week. The guidelines don't suggest a specific amount of time to spend on this effort. Evidence from a new study suggests that 30 to 60 minutes per week is a good goal. Published February 28, 2022 in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, the study pooled data from 16 earlier studies to explore how different types of exercise might affect longevity and the risk of dying from heart disease or other health conditions. Compared with people who did no strength training, those who did half an hour to one full hour of muscle-building exercise per week had a 10% to 17% reduction in the risk of early death, the researchers found. Strength training improves health problems that contribute to heart disease, says Dr. Beth Freites, clinical assistant professor of physical medicine and rehabilitation at Harvard Medical School. In one of the long-term studies included this analysis, researchers found that regular strength training lowers the risk of high blood pressure by 32% and the risk of metabolic syndrome by 29%. People with metabolic syndrome have at least three of these five problems: obesity, high blood triglycerides, low HDL cholesterol, high blood pressure, and high blood sugar. Don't assume you need to join a gym or buy weights to boost your strength. Body weight exercises in which you use your body itself as a weight can be an especially convenient way to build muscle strength. They include challenging exercises like pull-ups and planks, but also less intense ones like lunges and modified push-ups. You can do body weight exercises just about anywhere: in the kitchen waiting for water to boil, in your living room watching your favorite show, or at the park watching your grandkids play. Ideally, you should try to hit all the major muscle groups. If you're new to this type of exercise, it's best to find a supervised program through a senior center, a health club, or with a physical therapist to learn proper form, which is key to avoid injury. And this article also contains some instructions about how to do a stationary lunge and how to do a bench push-up. The next article in the Harvard Heart Letter of July 2022 is entitled How COVID-19 Can Compromise Your Heart Health. Even a mild case may raise your risk of cardiovascular disease for as long as a year afterward. 2 years into the coronavirus pandemic, almost half of all Americans have been infected with SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. While most have fully recovered, COVID survivors, even those with mild infections, face a higher risk of cardiovascular problems for up to 1 year later, a large study reports. We already knew that, like other serious infections, COVID-19 can cause inflammation that increases heart problems in the short term, that is, soon after the person is infected. This new study looked at longer-term chronic risk from 30 days up to 1 year after infection, says cardiologist Dr. C. Michael Gibson, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Published in March 2022 in Nature Medicine, the study relied on health records from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Researchers identified 153,760 people infected with the coronavirus between March 2020 and January 2021, and compared their rate of new cardiovascular symptoms with two groups of uninfected people in the VA system, about 5.6 million during the same period and 5.9 million before the pandemic. Compared with the uninfected people, COVID survivors were 72% more likely to develop heart failure, 63% more likely to have a heart attack, 52% more likely to experience a stroke. These heightened risks were evident regardless of age, race, and sex, and also appeared in people who were free of heart disease before they became infected, suggesting that even people at low cardiovascular risk are vulnerable to COVID's cardiac legacy, the authors say. What's more, increased risks were even seen in people who had milder cases that didn't require a hospital stay. However, people who were hospitalized, especially those who ended up in the intensive care unit, tended to face the highest risk of a serious heart-related problem during the year after they were infected. The SARS-CoV-2 virus wages attacks on many different fronts. The coughing, congestion, and fever triggered by the infection puts extra stress on the heart, which may struggle to meet the body's oxygen demands. The virus may also directly invade or inflame heart tissue, injuring the heart muscle. But the damage isn't limited to the chest. The virus can attack and injure the endothelium, the thin membrane that lines the inside of blood vessels. Says Dr. Gibson, the body's immune response triggers an outpouring of inflammatory cells that activates the clotting system, creating a dangerous combination of angry vessels and angry blood. As a result, blood clots can form in arteries and veins throughout the body and the brain. In addition to causing heart attacks and strokes, these clots can also lodge in leg veins, leading to deep vein thrombosis, or in the lungs, an uncommon but potentially deadly complication called pulmonary embolism. In the study, pulmonary embolism was nearly three times as common among COVID survivors compared with uninfected people. But being less active, possibly due to fatigue and other symptoms of long COVID, also leaves people more vulnerable to clots, Dr. Gibson noticed. Long COVID symptoms. Long COVID refers to symptoms like fatigue, body aches, shortness of breath and difficulty concentrating, or brain fog that continue or emerge weeks or months following COVID infection. Officially known as post-acute sequelae of SARS-CoV-2 infection, or PASC, the condition is thought to stem mainly from damage to the nervous system, although cardiovascular problems may also play a role. One common PASC symptom is dizziness and racing heart when a person stands up, known as postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, or POTS. I had this symptom myself after I recovered from COVID, said Dr. Gibson, who contracted the virus in early 2020 at the very start of the pandemic. While his symptoms have improved, PASC symptoms can endure much longer for some people. The recent study underscores the importance of not getting infected with COVID, says Dr. Gibson. Stay up to date with the CDC recommendations for vaccinations, boosters, and other steps to avoid the coronavirus. Finally, one more brief article. Smartwatch monitoring after a heart valve procedure. Smartwatches just keep getting smarter. The latest versions can estimate your blood oxygen level and record an EKG. A new study suggests these sophisticated devices may provide a safe, accurate way to monitor people at home after they undergo a minimally invasive heart valve replacement. The study included 100 people who had transcatheter aortic valve replacement, most of whom went home within a day or two after the procedure. All received a smartwatch that recorded their heart rate, steps, pulse, oxygen saturation, and an EKG measurement. During the next 30 days, the smartwatch detected 29 of 38 heart-related problems, mostly heart rhythm abnormalities, among 34 participants. The findings suggest that smartwatches could be an effective way to remotely monitor patients from home, say the authors, whose study was published March 29, 2022, in the Journal of the American Heart Association. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Heart Issues. I'm sorry, Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.